Many of us get tripped up over the miracle stories found in the Bible. Did Jesus really turn water into wine, or did they just happen to find a few more cases out back in the barn? Did the disciples really feed 5,000 with that one basket of fish, or did they just convince everyone to share what they had brought in their own picnic baskets? But when we get to the healing stories, the longing to understand intensifies. After all, who among us has not prayed for a child to live who ultimately died? Who among us has not buried a grandparent that we were not quite ready to let go of? And most of us have prayed for our own pain to be diminished and found that God did not seem to hear. So what are we to make of these stories where Jesus appears to heal instantly? You and I live in a scientific world where stem cell research and organ transplants and customized chemotherapy and antidepressant pharmaceuticals are the customary methods for healing. So we struggle to grasp what was happening in a pre-scientific world when Jesus made a bit of mud paste and rubbed it on a man's eyes and he could suddenly see. Was this simply a metaphor that the man could finally see what was happening, what was finally true? And then there's that story about the bleeding woman reaching out to touch the hem of Jesus' garment and is instantly healed. And we wonder, was it partly psychological? When Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead, we wonder, was Lazarus in a coma and then he woke up? We look at the clues around the healing story to try to find some deeper truth about this God we worship. But today's story throws us a curveball. There are few clues. Jesus never even comes face to face with the person that he heals. Jesus never even meets the soldier who requests healing on behalf of his slave. We are not told what the illness was, only that it was grave, for he was near death. And we don't know how the healing took place. Was it with mud paste, or with touch, or with prayer, or with oils? The problem here is that the miracle takes place off stage, and Luke doesn't tell us anything about it, except that it happened. You might be familiar with offstage miracles from your own life experience. Just recently, someone shared with me this story. It seems that in April, our church sent a team of volunteers out into the community to work at Sheffield Place as a part of our Grace at Work Day. They were charged with cleaning up a yard and landscaping it so that a new resident could move into a home. The home was being prepared for a woman who had been homeless and addicted to drugs and was living in the Sheffield Place apartments and was now ready to try life on her own with her family. Kevin Briggs, a member of our church, was on that work team. And about a month after the landscaping project, Kevin showed up at Sheffield Place with one of our small groups to serve Cinco de Mayo dinner. During the dinner, he happened to sit next to a woman who had been at Sheffield Place for some time. She started telling Kevin about her story, about how Sheffield Place had helped her transition, and she was now about to leave the teeny tiny apartment she shared with her children and move into her own home. She described the house, and she said, "A group of people just landscaped it, and it looks great." And Kevin smiled and said, "Yeah, I was a part of the team that landscaped your home." The two of them became emotional as Kevin shared with her that when they worked in the yard, he had prayed for whoever might move in there. And she began crying as the two of them sat there over tacos, realizing what a turning point this was. Now, we might ordinarily say that the miracle, the main event, was that she was getting off drugs and moving into a new home. And it is a great thing. Or we might say the miracle was this team of volunteers landscaping the yard, or this other team of volunteers serving dinner. But surely God was at work also in this little tiny moment where a well-heeled professional man and a struggling single homeless mom were sharing tears of joy and a vision of hope. Perhaps Luke intentionally leaves this miraculous healing story off stage as a way of nudging you and I to pay attention to the little miracles that take place in our own lives that are seldom seen by others. And yet these miracles shape us. A couple of weeks ago, I was in New Orleans with my parents for my niece's graduation from Tulane. The activities were jam-packed from 8 o'clock in the morning until late at night. We had all these events to attend, but one afternoon, between graduation speeches and dinners, my dad and I thought we have a long enough break that we could go to the World War II Museum. As we purchased our tickets, the woman behind the counter whined to us, "You know, the museum closes in 1 hour, and it takes about 4 hours to adequately see the exhibit." My dad and I paid our $43, and we started speeding through that museum. We went through the road to Berlin, and lickety-split, we went on the road to Tokyo, and I figured we were probably going so fast through this museum that we weren't really absorbing anything significant. We didn't read anything. We didn't watch any films. We were just speeding through that war. And then we entered the fourth building. It's four stories high, and suspended from the ceiling are the bomber planes. You could go up the elevator and go across these catwalks and look straight into the plane and see where the gunners sat and where the pilots sat. And my dad stopped on the catwalk, and he started describing to me which of his uncles fought in the war. And he started explaining to me the strategy employed by the bombers and the gunners. And he said that when those planes came back, they were often so torn up, and many of them were shot down over enemy territory. And my father began to cry. And I looked at my dad, and I knew more about the war and more about my dad than I had known before. To him, this was not a historical museum. This was a personal reality. This war had shaped his politics, his civic convictions, and his faith. The pain and the sorrow was still there. It was our little offstage miracle, where dad and daughter connected. I tell you, the graduation was the main event, and it was great. The museum is a stunning place. Reserve 4 hours to see it. But what I will never forget was that little moment suspended on the catwalk with my dad. Knowing that these little offstage miracles do occur in real life, I am still curious about what actually happened in Luke's story where the centurion's slave was healed. Maybe by now, Luke just takes it for granted that healing happens. After all, this is the sixth healing story in the first seven chapters of Luke. So instead of telling us what happened to bring that slave back from the brink of death, Luke matter-of-factly reports it almost as an afterthought. Oh yeah, when they got back to the house, they found that he was in good health. Well, come on, Luke. Did they have a party? Were people shocked? Did he fall down and worship Jesus? Apparently, Luke does not find this to be the important part of the story. So let's look back and see what it is that Luke does put on center stage. Luke tells it like this. A commanding officer of the Roman army sends a delegation of Jewish leaders to Jesus to plead with Jesus to come and heal his prized slave. Jesus agrees, drops everything, and heads towards the centurion's home. Suddenly, he is intercepted by the Roman officer's friends. They bring a message. "Stop! No need to come. I am unworthy of your company. Just speak the word and my slave will be healed." But in order for this story to have the same shock value for you and me as it did for Luke's original audience, hear it this way. An ISIS recruit sent a group of his Roman Catholic friends to the Pope to ask for a special blessing upon his favorite slave. The Pope got in the Popemobile and headed toward the Middle East to assist, but the entourage was stopped by a group of his friends who said, "Our friend, the ISIS military officer, has so much faith in you, the Pope, that he believes you can heal even from a distance." You see, in the time that Luke writes this story, Roman soldiers are the enemy. They are destroying the Jewish people and destroying the Jewish temple. A Gentile, like the Roman soldier, would defile the home of a Jewish person just by walking in the door. The political divisions, the religious animosity, the social segregation is at an all-time high, which might remind you of the world in which we live today. Even within our own country, the polarization between political ideologies, candidates, socioeconomic groups, and religions can be terribly disheartening. So Luke tells us a story where all these different groups with different perspectives come together to advocate for the healing of one of the least in their society. When Jesus sees these disparate groups coming together, not as enemies, but as a community of compassion, Jesus is amazed. I am reminded of a story that I heard on NPR a few years ago about Sergeant Paul Bryan, who was an American soldier deployed to Iraq to serve with the 34th Military Police Company. Paul was assigned an interpreter who was from Iraq. The two men feared one another. On the day that they met, the U.S. sergeant told his interpreter, "If you mess with my soldiers, I will shoot you." The Iraqi interpreter said that he hated Americans, thought of all of them as the enemy. That's how he'd been raised. But over time, the two men became friends. The U.S. soldier said, "My Iraqi interpreter became my American brother." The U.S. soldier began to worry that after he returned back to the States, that the Iraqi interpreter would be persecuted or even killed for assisting the Americans. And so when the American sergeant came home, he secured a visa for his new brother, the interpreter, to immigrate to the United States. The two men lived together in Minnesota and began working together for a way to bring the interpreter's wife and children also to the U.S. As I read Luke's story, I hear a similar friendship unfolding between disparate parties. A Gentile Roman officer befriends a Jewish religious leader and begins to advocate for his slave to be healed by this new voice called Jesus. Now I am beginning to see why the physical healing story remains offstage, for the real miracle is the power of community forming among such radically different people. When we live in a society fractured by religious, political, and social divisions, maybe the harder thing for you and I to believe is that our community also might be healed. Maybe Luke puts this story center stage to grab our attention and to say to us that our community too can become a place of wholeness, unity, and compassion. I had a strange thing happen to me when we were in India last January. Our mission team was planning to have a quiet little communion service on Sunday morning in our apartment before we headed out for the day's activities. We had invited three other Americans who were volunteering at the hospital to come and join us for that early morning service. I set out some bread and some juice and prepared for about 12 to share this meal. And as I was waiting for people to gather, someone came rushing into our apartment and said, "We're moving the communion service over to the chapel at the hospital." And I was befuddled. "Why?" I said. "Because the community found out about it and they all want to come. The bus drivers and the nurses and the staff members and the students, they've all been invited. They're coming to communion." And I ran to the kitchen to find more bread and wine. And as I headed over to the chapel, my mind was racing, for I hadn't planned for a crowd and had no message prepared, and I didn't know what to say. When we got to the chapel, we discovered that the ceiling had fallen in the front of the chapel right there, and there was just debris everywhere. And I thought, this could not get any worse. So we set up a few chairs in the very back, and people gathered around, and some stood, and we sang some songs, and I spoke, and we prayed. And then I started to pass the bread and the cup to the person next to me so that it could go around the circle of the gathered community. And as I turned to do that, I heard this, and I was like, "What's going on?" And someone whispered to me, "Some who have gathered are not baptized Christians. Some of them are Hindu." I froze. I didn't want to exclude anyone, but I didn't want to violate any cultural norms. And so I put the bread and the cup back down on the table, and I said, "These are the gifts of God from heaven. If you wish to receive, you are invited to come forward." And they came forward, and they broke the bread, and they took the wine. And afterwards, when everyone left, I said to the head of the hospital, Dr. Henry, "What was that? What happened?" And he said, "Oh, I decided to invite everyone to communion." And I said, "But Dr. Henry, I was so unprepared." And he defended his action. He said, "I did it on purpose. When I heard you were having communion, I knew this was the chance for the Indian people to see a vision of communion that they have never seen before in India. For them, communion is a stilted ritual, but for you, it is a symbol of God's holy community." Some people, he told me, had never taken communion until that moment. Despite my best laid plans, the Spirit intervened and gave all of us a glimpse of how God might heal our world.